Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 244 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the second line of podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me tonight is one of the greatest voices of the Second Amendment, and the greatest hostess in the world, and she smells of flowers. Erin Paulette! How you doing, Erin? I know that sound.
It's been a
friggin'
month, Weird. It's been a month.
It's good. This is going to be one of those shows, people. Buckle up, because Erin's pulling straight from the bottle.
I'm not going to...
I learned early in my college drinking career, you don't pull directly from the bottle.
I don't do it often.
I know.
It's been a month, folks. I'm not going to get into it in detail. I've got part one on my blog, and there's going to be part two coming this week. So by the time this drops, you'll know exactly all the things March did to me. But So the good news is I missed last week because we had a mold problem, and I'll get into the details in the blog post. But when the insurance company sends the people and they go, yeah, that's mold and that needs to be cleaned out, and they send out professionals who tape off the room like a crime scene and use industrial tools to rip everything out and the air scrubbers and things like that. But the good news is the mold is all gone, as are most of the walls and all the carpet, and it's a mess. But at least that part of the house is certified mold-free. So, how are you doing, Weird?
I mean, slightly better. I've just been busy, because my wife got herself a promotion, and so that's the promotion good. The fact that they don't just give you a promotion, bad. She has been, like, so overworked. There's, like, a bunch of things all happening at once. She's taking on the new responsibilities that she's got, and then also some regular old stuff blew up at work, and then, yeah, and then it's tax season, and so, yeah, it's been fun.
Is she still pulling obnoxiously long hours at work?
Thankfully, no. But yes, yeah. I don't think I was telling the show about that. But yeah, when this all started, and the thing that one of the big things that blew up at work blew up. Yeah, no, she was working like close to 18 hours a day for a week, and my wife is not one of those people. I am quite good at waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and being up all day and then sitting down with you at 9 or 10 and going until midnight and then going back to bed, and I'm gonna get tired, and one of these days I'm gonna tomorrow I'm probably going to be asleep by 8:30, but my wife is one of those ones of no, she needs at least 8 hours a night, and if it doesn't happen, it's not pretty. But yes, no. So luckily, she has been sleeping a lot better. She's just been very, very stressed out and busy, and so I am.
Well, I mean, 18 hours a day, 5 days a week is a 90-hour work week.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. No. Now she's back. She's back down to her usual like 50 or 60. There's a reason why I don't go by stay-at-home dad and refer to myself as a housewife, because I'm like the one of the other stay-at-home moms on the street was like, so you're thinking about going back to work when your daughter's a little bit older? And I'm like, probably not, because she's the easy part of the job. The big part is keeping my wife from dying.
Huh?
Oh, just I am just as much a support crew for her as I am for my daughter.
Okay.
She needs to make sure that she has food and her clothing and all the stuff, and that there is when the weekend comes around, there's nothing for her to do, so that she can relax, so she can go back to her grueling hours.
Okay. Weird Beard the trad husb.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's nothing trad. Well, trad wife.
Well, That was the joke. Yes. Yeah, instead of a trad wife, you're a trad hubs.
Yes, very much. But it doesn't work because the trad hubs would mean that I would put on a coat and hat in the morning and drive into work while smoking cigarettes. Yeah. Yep. And honestly speaking, we talked about it last week, the shooting in Nashville. I only wanted to dig up a few more bits of information that have come to light in the previous week.
Kudos to the Nashville police for showing Uvalde how it's freaking done. Good on them. I mean, I think it was like 14 minutes for them to neutralize the shooter. And honestly, I think most of that was just them getting there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really the only thing you can fault them on. It's not really their fault. They don't have transporter beams there. They've got to physically drive there. But that is really phenomenal response time, especially for a big city. And, you're going to talk about the body camera footage. And I think this is the first time we have body camera footage of an event like this. And They went in hard, and they communicated, and they had good lines of fire. Or so I'm told. I can't bring myself to watch it, but people who have watched it have, you know, saying this is really professional. And so good for them for not only doing a good job, but now this can be used as a training tool for other police departments. You know, here's how you do this. And hopefully they can learn from it.
Yeah. No, this was just an amazing, just the, you see the first officer get on the scene, and oh crap, I'm terrible with names. So the
Rex, I think
Rex is his first name. That's Rex Engelbert is the is off officer one and the first officer to put rounds into the killer. And he gets out of his car. He addresses a teacher of some sort that is there waiting for them. Immediately goes into the back of his cruiser. Retrieves his patrol rifle. Gets it up there. Power strokes the round into the chamber with authority and just starts talking to the other officers, getting him to stack up. And clearly, it's one of those. He says, "I need one more." Meaning that, like, they've got it set up so that they're working on, I think, 3-man fire teams. And so once they get into that unit, they all know their role and they go in there. And I'll tell you, even though I know for a fact, as I've read the news and all that, none of the officers get wounded, but God, like them pulling the doors open and it opens up into that long hall, and you know that someone could be proned out or ducking around a corner from behind some cover with a rifle or something, and just start shooting.
Just walking into a fatal funnel, basically.
Yes, exactly. And then of course they ended up subduing the killer up on the second floor, and so. They have to take the stairwells, and there's a Clint Smith video out there of him talking with a bunch of people, talking about how clearing a stairwell, there's a million ways to do it. None of them are good. And he said, the only way to safely clear a stairwell is to get out there, get on the radio and call in an airstrike.
I mean, I would think a grenade would work.
I mean, even then there's a lot of corners in stairwells. So
that's true. Okay.
So yeah, there's, I will say that, like, even on the stairwell of my own house, unless they get the stairwell directly up onto the landing, yeah, there's ways for me to avoid it. So yeah, no, he was just saying, yeah, you just call a JDAM in. And so, but yeah, so that, I mean, they take the stairwell, they're clearing rooms as they're going through and all that. And then suddenly, like, it actually becomes less tense the moment they start hearing gunfire, and it's actually the shooter is in a second floor window and shooting down at the cops in the parking lot. So actually they ended up shooting the shooter probably in the back because that person was engaging the police out in the parking lot at the time that they came around the corner. And they shot the Rex Engelbert shot the killer, and they went down, but they went down on their back with the rifle, which was, I believe, the Kel-Tec sub 2000. in their hands. And then Officer Michael Collazo, who's got his pistol in his hand, as soon as it gets through, he charges forward. And since their hand is on the pistol, he puts several more shots into him while yelling, "Stop moving," which I take a little bit of gallows humor in, because that is a way to get someone to stop moving. And the killer is sufficiently stopped moving. And I am pleased with this. My overall statement, especially after the Aurora, Colorado shooting, I have been very, very thankful every time the shooter is dead one way or the other, because nothing good comes from them being alive. And so it's not like we get any more answers or anything like that. So better they just be dead and stop taking up space. And so, yeah. So either way, if you are not sensitive to such things, again, Aaron, I don't hold it against you. I asked you to watch just the first minute of the video I have posted, just to see Rex stacking up against the door and hearing the enthusiasm in his voice. And you know for a fact that he is just filled with adrenaline and not looking forward to this in any way, shape, or form. But he knows he's got a job, and he does this job. And any recognition that these officers get for their heroism is not going to be enough. Like the even though the fact that the shooter's tactics sucked and they were not a particular threat to any of the officers entering, and no officers were harmed in this entry, or the ones that were in the parking lot taking fire, even that, you don't know that. You don't know that this person's just a goon. They could be, the whole purpose of this could be, they're going to kill a few kids in the school and just to bring the officers in so they could get some cops. You never know. And so the amount of bravery from all of these officers, every last one of them, I named the two officers who actually got shots on the killer, because, again, it is my policy. I haven't said the killer's name. I'm not going to say the killer's name. I am just saying the killer. As simple as that, because I'm not going to bring any fame to this person. I'm not going to give them any more attention than they need to, but I will give all the attention in the world to the people that put an end to this person, because those are the heroes and those people deserve attention. And if I may use that as a transition to this, I'm reading between the lines a little bit. I am taking some liberties, but this news article that I found here, and there's several instances, it has been said by the chief of police in Nashville that the shooter had contemplated several targets, but selected the school because of their security, of which there was none. They didn't have a resource officer. It's a school, so therefore it's a gun-free zone, both in, I believe, Tennessee and federal law. And so this person knew that they weren't the only police that were going to be on scene were ones that were going to show up after they started shooting. But one of the targets that they looked at, and I have to assume, again, the manifesto hasn't been released yet. I intend to read it just to get more information, and read it so you don't have to, because
thank you.
I gain comfort from the more knowledge. Just an interesting fact. I don't know if anybody cares. When I first arrived at college and I had my first broadband internet connection, it wasn't very long before I stumbled on my first gore site with just pictures of people in horrible states. And I would look at it and I would be shocked and chilled and feel my stomach drop and all of that. But ever so often I'd find a picture that would have either a newspaper article or a coroner's file next to it and all that. It would tell about that. And those pictures, no matter how mutilated the body was, if I knew what caused the damage and all that, suddenly it wouldn't cause that visceral reaction to me, because then I would actually start looking at it as more of data than just a horrible thing. Just how my brain works. But so that's, I gain comfort in learning more about these events that disturb me and upset me. And this is,
that's fine. I mean, that's why different people exist. Mm-hmm. I can't bear to read it, but as you say, there is important knowledge that can, not necessarily will, but could be gained from it. And so great. You look at it and you analyze it. That means I don't have to.
But the point that I'm getting at is that the killer was believed to be planning an attack on a local mall. And I made a connection here. This is, again, me taking a liberty, but I'm going to run with it because I think it's good. Is that let's actually go another way. Aaron.
Yes.
You are awful with names, aren't you?
I am. Who are you again?
Yes, my name is Susan. If you were to say, I would give you a free bottle of rum, a very high end, your choice.
Mm-hmm.
If you could name both of the killers in Columbine, could you do it?
Well, not at the moment. I'm drawing a complete blank.
Well, that's good, actually.
Wait. Hang on. One of the names coming to me, and I swear to you, I'm not Googling. I think one of them is Klebold.
Yes.
And
we don't need to name them. The answer is just you've answered the question on just the yes or no. Could you name the Virginia Tech shooter?
No, but I'm pretty sure he had a Vietnamese name.
I think so. I think he was Korean, actually, but yes. How about, but either way, the point that I'm making and listeners at home, like, you go over some mass shootings starting back with Columbine and see how many of them that you can name the killers of, and then move forward. And I just say, like, I know the names of all of these killers just because I'm following the news stories and it's just ingrained in my brain. I've heard their names spoken enough times that it's part of my memory. I could not tell you the name of the person that shot up the Greenwood Mall in Indiana, like, even remotely.
But we remember the name of Eli Dickin.
I sure do remember the name of Eli Dickin. And guess what? Most people in even in remotely gun spaces, if you say Eli Dickin, or even better, the Dickin drill. Something that I almost always do at the end of any range session. I'll take the target and I'll crank it all the way out, and I'll brace myself, allow myself a brace against the sturdy surface, and I'll see how tight a group I can shoot on that target. And yeah, so the Eli Dickin and the Dickin drill. Everybody knows about Eli Dickin. And what did Eli Dickin do? Some jerk came into a mall and decided to start shooting people. And he only got a couple of shots off before Eli Dickin braced himself against the pole and smoked him from, I can't even remember the range, but I want to say 75 yards with an open sight pistol. And he's a damn hero, and he deserves it, as does Jack Wilson, who did a similar feat of amazing marksmanship in that was White Settlement, Texas. And then, of course, we got Stephen Willifert in what was the name of that town? That was Sutherland Springs, who engaged the shooter as he was exiting the church. And so we know the names of these heroes, and these men are heroes because, just like the Nashville police, when somebody bad was doing something, they knew that it was the first responder's job to stop it. And I would like to think right now, maybe we won't get any information even from the manifesto when it's released, but I would like to think that this sick jerk thought about Eli Dickin when they thought about going to a mall, which I would argue would probably have a lot more people out in the open and has a higher probability of getting more kills. And thought about Eli Dickin and realized that they might get killed. There are photos of the dead person that Eli Dickin killed, and it is humiliating towards that person. And I encourage you to Google it if you have a stomach to look at dead people, because it's showing another side to these spree killers, not these feared and loathed, but they're getting attention people, but people that are getting ridicule, people that are losers, people that are not successful or impressive people, and they die unsuccessful and unimpressively.
Mm-hmm. And I've actually seen, admittedly pixelated, but pictures of the deceased shooter, and someone has photoshopped a Twister board underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably in poor taste, but I find it funny because, yes, let's mock these people. Let's let them know. Well, let's send a message to other would-be shooters that when you fail, we're going to make fun of you in your death. And if they're doing it for fame, then let's counter that with ridicule.
I concur. It would be fair taste or poor taste. If it was someone that was worthy of any respect whatsoever, and this person is not.
Clearly.
And so I strongly encourage the memification of this person. So long as, again, you're not getting splash damage to people that might be your allies. And we mentioned last week that there is some question. Aaron and I were talking a bunch about it. If you're on the ACP blooper reel, that'll probably come up in there, just because it was an interesting discussion.
Not blooper reel. It was a mag dump.
I'm talking about what we just talked about before the show started.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about that during the show or
yeah. I don't want to get too deep into it because, again, it's a lot of speculation.
That's fine.
On it, but either way, I was referring to the shooter using a female pronoun, and you stopped me, which you absolutely should have, knowing what you knew, saying that, oh, let's not be jerks. And
well, here, let me handle this because I'm the one who said it. And I know people are gonna, well, maybe I'm doing our listeners a disservice, but they may be thinking, well, of course Aaron's gonna say this, Aaron's trans. And yeah, obviously that plays into it, but here's my logic, and I'm going to do it by terms of analogy. I absolutely loathe Chelsea Manning. I believe Chelsea Manning is a traitor and should have been executed as such, but I will never refer to Chelsea Manning as Bradley because I want people to agree with me on the important points that Manning is a traitor. If I misgender Manning, some of the people that I want to agree with me will immediately shut off because I have misgendered Manning. Sort of like the way someone says, I'm a gun owner, but, and you stop listening. And so I think it's important to concede the smaller points. And honestly, it doesn't really matter if this shooter is male or female or trans or non-binary, whatever. You know, murderous assholes come in all stripes. No one is innocent, except maybe people with Down syndrome, because they're some of the most awesome innocent people I've ever met.
But
other than that, I mean, the inner murderous asshole can come out of any one of us. And so I'm not saying that because, you know, trans people are sacred, need to be respected. It's just, no, concentrate on the important point. You know, the important part of your message is this person did something monstrous and we denounce that. Let's not get caught up in other things, which is a perfect segue to something else that I want to talk about here. And so, Weirdbeard, take a drink, because I'm going to get up on my soapbox for a minute.
No problem.
So, the popular take du jour among conservative people is that they're going, well, transgender people are mentally ill, and mentally ill people shouldn't have access to guns. And I will concede that while this is certainly a very spicy take, I don't think it's a very conservative one, because I want people to stop and think a minute about what is being said. These people are agitating for the removal of constitutional rights without due process, which is not a conservative viewpoint at all. And the only reason they're doing it is because they know it will be used to punish a demographic they don't like. The thing is, they don't realize, I'm pretty sure they don't realize, because if they're doing it while they realize it, they're stupid. They are sowing the seeds of their own destruction. They are sowing off the branch that they sit on, because what they're doing by advocating for this, well, of course, assuming it passes, but let's say they get what they want here. They have made it that much easier to have their Second Amendment rights removed the next time the gun prohibitionists are in power. So, for example, all right, they're saying because gender dysphoria is in the DSM, that makes it a mental illness. And it's not. We won't get into that. It's a little bit off the in the weeds. But here's another thing that's in the DSM. It's called oppositional defiant disorder. And it manifests as anger and defiance towards authority figures. So, you know, if you're a person who is very vocal about your distrust of authority, like the government, and you don't trust them, and if they tell you to turn in your guns, you won't, hey, you clearly have oppositional defiant disorder. And that means you're mentally ill. And so that means you should lose your Second Amendment rights for the good of all. Stop doing this. Just due process exists to protect us all. Don't advocate against removing it. And just stop and think for a moment. Just, you know, black hat or whatever the term is. It's like, if I get my way, how could it be used against me if my political opponents get in power? And if you can think of a situation that's bad, don't do that. What I want to point out is that we minority gun owners, in this particular instance at least, we're the canary in the coal mine here. And once we lose our rights, it becomes so much easier to take your rights away. So protect us so that it makes it that much harder to take them away from you.
Yeah, and very similar to the statement made by Jesus, let he who has not sinned cast the first stone. Let he who is neurotypical cast the first stone. I mean, there's just, we all got something. Let's not just assume that because you're going to point fingers at one group, the fact that, oh, you have ADD, or you have clinical depression, or you have a learning disorder, or you have PTSD, or you have, the list goes on of things that are, that we all need help with or dealing with, that are relatively minor, and you're going to be high functioning and you're going to be just fine. But guess what? If they really want to take your guns away, they'll find a reason.
Yeah, PTSD is actually a really great example, because I truly can't know how many veterans out there need help, but they've been told that if they get help, they'll be denied their Second Amendment rights, and they decide, I would rather be able to defend myself and suffer than get help and be disarmed. And that's not a good choice. I need to be careful not to go off onto a side rant here. I just want to point out that mental illness is not contagious. Neither is cancer, but for so long we treated cancer like you could catch it. And so we shunned people. And, you know, while some people with mental illness can be dangerous if they're violent, in the same way that some people can have an illness which is contagious and can kill you, there are other mental illnesses which don't hurt anyone except the afflicted, and you don't need to be scared of them. And honestly, this goes back, culturally, this goes back at least to the Middle Ages, and there's probably something in our animal brain as well. You know, someone's not acting right, they might be sick, they might hurt us, we need to shun them. But let's try to get past these reflexes and start understanding that sometimes mental illness is like the flu, and it can be treated, and people can get better and you don't get sick from being around them. Let's not demonize people seeking help.
Yep. Let's not demonize people, and let's not go after this person because of their gender identity one way or the other. And I will say right now that in all of my looking at the information on that, there, I'll just say there is some ambiguity. And so I don't know what the reality is as far as this killer's gender identity is. And so, and maybe this will be revealed, maybe it will never be revealed. But I will just say that, you know, even if you're a super duper anti-trans conservative, it's not going to be doing you any favors to make fun of this person's gender identity. Make fun of the fact that they're a complete and utter loser and they ended up getting completely smoked by the police while they were shooting in the wrong direction. So, you know, there's plenty and the fact that they just killed a bunch of, you know, teachers and a couple of kids, just this is not an impressive person. And unless you've got anything else, I'd like to move on to a happier topic.
Well, I've got a perfect transitional topic here because I am making fun of someone noteworthy, but it is still topical. Let's talk about one of your favorite gun controllers, Ryan Bussey.
Ah, yes.
And I don't think he saw this, but I took him apart on Twitter and it made me feel better. So he was talking about how the killer used a Kel-Tec Sub 2000, which is a gun that I have had for about a decade now, and it's a fantastic little carbine. And, of course, he's all a Twitter about it. And so I'm going to read his statement, then I'm going to read mine, and you'll know which ones are his. One of the guns used in Tennessee is a Kel-Tec Sub 2000. It's built around accepting high-capacity Glock magazines, always considered to be the sort of gun that had no respectable purpose. It folds in half for easy transfer into a place like a school. And just out of... I just want to observe here that the bio for Ryan Bussey does mention him as being a hunter. So you'd think that he would know things about guns, but if he's a hunter, he's a FUD.
Oh, he's solidly a FUD.
And so in the guise, in the role of the Pink Pistols Twitter account, I unpacked this. It's built around accepting high-capacity Glock magazines. No, it's built around accepting the most common pistol magazine in North America. There are other magazine formats in existence like Beretta, Smith & Wesson, Colt, etc. Glock just has better name recognition. And I ran out of characters, but that's really why. You know, he mentioned Glock because, Glock, it's all in the TV, it's all in the rap, it's the one that everyone hears about. And so, it's high capacity. No, standard capacity. Although, you can put higher capacity in it, but really, what he's going for is Glock is scary here. Always considered to be the sort of gun that had no respectable purpose. It's like, first of all, citation needed. Mm-hmm. I've owned a Sub 2000 for over a decade, and while much shade has been thrown at Kel-Tec guns, not once have I heard it described as not having a reputable use. I use mine for home defense. And then I tagged Kel-Tec, basically saying, you know, the fact that this is the kind of gun only used by criminals sounds damaging and defamatory, and I sure hope their lawyers take a look at this. It folds in half for easy transfer into a place like a school. So, this kind of sophistry is much favored by gun prohibitionists due to its flexibility. So, if the gun is small, then it's perfect for smuggling into places for murder. If the gun is large, then it's either a long-range sniper rifle that can kill people at extreme range, or it's a large bore cannon that explodes targets and leaves gaping holes. Either way, the gun is bad and must be banned. In conclusion, the only thing you said which wasn't hyperbolic is, one of the guns used in Tennessee is a Kel-Tec Sub 2000.
And may I add that we have footage of the killer entering the school, and they did so by shooting out the windows and of those glass doors, And this was not a bright person. When you shoot out the glass doors, you reach around and grab the crash bar and pull the door open. And this person walked through the broken glass hole. I hope you got cut. I hope you had broken glass in your shoes.
I hope you were a glass hole.
Yeah, exactly. The well played. But I will note that there's lots of footage of the sub 2000. And at no point is it folded.
Of course, it can't shoot while folded. It's designed not to.
Yeah. So the idea that it was brought into the school, first up, it appears that the person may have used and may have only used the AR pistol to shoot through the windows, which I have some theories about this. But then immediately they switched to the sub 2000 and... there's no footage of the people that were killed being killed. So it's unknown at this point in time if they were killed with the sub 2000 or with the AR. I don't think the person ever used their pistol. But the fact that he's talking about, oh, it's folded so it can get into a school. There was no stealth or subterfuge being used at all in this. This was absolutely a breach entry. So, yeah, Ryan Bussey is just being a fool. Per usual. So, can we talk about some good news, Aaron?
Yes, let's.
Well, there's news from Florida. Do you want to take it, Aaron? Because you're probably following it closer than I am.
Well, introduce me so you'll have something to say, and then I will go into greater detail because this affects me.
Well, I'll read the headline. DeSantis signs permitless carry gun bill into law with little fanfare.
Yeah, and the usual suspects are all a vapor about this because, yeah, he signed a bill he said he would sign. I don't understand it. I obviously understand why they're having a fit over this, but I don't know why they're having a fit over the fact that it was done with a little fanfare. I mean, honestly, if he'd done it with a lot of fanfare, they would have found something wrong with that. It's like, here he is glorifying making, you know, these murder tools easier for everyone to use, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, they're going to find something regardless. So, Florida permitless carry is not like other permitless carry, because other permitless carries are kind of like constitutional carry, except for that one little bit where they're different. But the point being is that you can carry concealed, you can carry openly. I'm just going to call it Florida carry. How about that? Florida carry is you can carry concealed and only concealed without a permit. So it's not great in the way that these other constitutional or permitless carry states, but it's still good because, you know, in order to get a concealed carry permit in Florida, you have to attend a safety class, which in my case took about an evening, and I had to put X number of shots on paper at a reasonably close distance. It's been over a decade. I don't remember now. And had to pay for the class and then had to pay for the application packet where they would do the background check. And I had to pay for the photograph. And, you know, I went to a police station and they fingerprinted me. And it was a pain in the butt. And it wasn't super expensive, but it was expensive. And so this eliminates all that. As long as you aren't a prohibited person, you can carry concealed and only concealed. So if you are a per person who wants to defend yourself by carrying concealed, you can do that now. That's great. It doesn't really affect me because I've already got the permit and the permit carries other things, which we'll discuss later on in the show. And, of course, having the permit gives me reciprocity across a bunch of states. But this is still overall a good thing because, in addition to making it accessible to people who couldn't afford to carry before, it is an intermediary step. And that's the way we are in Florida. We've got to dip our toe in the water. And after we do this for however many years, and, you know, we don't have, you know, blood in the streets, shootouts over parking spaces, they will eventually say, you know what, we should make this actual constitutional carry. So it's a halfway step, but it's still a pretty good one. It just doesn't benefit me in the short term.
Yeah, I just like the fact that in the event that in during the one of my first renewal cycles, because I wasn't going to apply for carry permits for states outside of Massachusetts until I could legally carry in Massachusetts, because what's the point? If you've got to disarm before you come home. And so once I got my Massachusetts permit, I got my Maine permit, my New Hampshire permit, and it was a little while later before I got my Florida permit. And my first renewal was right in the middle of the big Obama gun rush, the one where you couldn't find 22. Yeah. And not only could you not find 22, but everyone was struggling to get their permits filled. And my Maine permit ended up expiring by, I want to say, 2 months. It was a while before I got my Maine permit renewed. Even though,
well, I mean, to be clear, if I recall the story, you sent in the paperwork in plenty of time. It was just the Massachusetts government that took its sweet time in getting it back to you.
Well, yeah, that's the Massachusetts side. The Maine one was just, they were just so swamped with new permits because so many people were applying for permits in the state of Maine that they just didn't have enough people to process them all in a timely fashion. Massachusetts just, they intentionally don't have enough people. That's the juice. And so my Maine permit expired. And so suddenly it was one of those, and this was before Maine got constitutional carry. And so I couldn't carry in the state of Maine. So when I went to go visit my family, I couldn't carry my gun. I mean, technically I could have open carried, but I generally don't open carry. And so, yeah, that was the, you know, that is a tricky thing that sometimes happens. And to know that, you can have a brain fart and fail to renew your permit in Massachusetts because they never let you know your permit's expired. I know for a fact that Florida absolutely lets you know, hey, your permit's about to expire. Why don't you huck us some money? And you know what? God bless you. Yeah, I'll send you some money. And so, yeah, this is a very, very good thing. It is not a perfect bill, but let's not let perfect be the enemy of good. And I know you are particularly upset with the fact that Florida does not have open carry. And I will argue that, at least when I first started getting into activism, there were two wonky states. There were three. There was Illinois that didn't issue permits at all. There was Wisconsin that didn't issue concealed carry permits, but you could open carry. And there was Florida that did not allow open carry at all. And I saw Florida and Wisconsin as opposite sides of the same coin in the fact that Wisconsin has brutal winters. And if you are bundled up for winter, how on earth are you going to open carry a gun? The only way I could think about it is police officers have these overcoats that have the slit up the side where they pull the gun through and then snap the snaps around it so that they're reasonably covered from snow, but their firearm is outside their coat. And yeah, they don't. Yeah, it's like, of course you say, huh? I'm like, why would you say, huh? Oh, wait. Yeah, the Florida cops don't have that crap.
No. It was more a case of, I didn't think that was, but yeah, I now envision it. Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, you see it everywhere here in New England because, yeah, it's freezing cold. And so they have these essentially, like, they're often like safety yellow, essentially great coats, but they've got slits up both sides with snaps on them, and you just unsnap the ones that are whatever, you know, how you're, depending on how your body is, where your gun is, pull your holster through it and then snap the snaps around it so that it's sealed up behind it. And so you'll see a cop there with a long coat and a Glock hanging out. And so
just with a Glock hanging out in front of God and everyone.
Yeah, we do in phrasing. But yeah, and so the idea of open carrying in a Wisconsin winter is insane. And then on top of that, Florida is at really, really dang hot most of the year. You can pretty much, unless you live in Florida, you can get away with wearing shorts and a t-shirt every day of the year.
Pretty much. I mean, definitely a good solid 9 months of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the idea that I would be in Florida wearing a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and it being hot and humid out, but somehow I need to conceal a firearm is just not a fair thing to put on somebody. And so it sucks that. And then on top of that, I believe every state should be open carry, and I think everybody should support open carry, even if you don't open carry, because there's always the premise of accidental exposure.
And I think as a response to that, I believe that's why Florida definitely does not have laws against printing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, other states do, and you've got to have a concealment garment, but here in Florida, you know, you can have on a tight t-shirt and it's obvious you've got a gun under there, but if you can't see the gun, then it's concealed. And I'm pretty sure that was done deliberately, pretty much for the heat factor.
I think that was changed, wasn't it? I remember hearing when that law got changed. It was like somewhere around like 2012, if I remember correctly.
No, I think what you're thinking of, and I could very much be mistaken, I believe it was in 2012, 2013, that they made it okay to briefly expose.
That is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, prior to that, it's like you had to be covered up all the time, and any exposure you could get arrested for. But they made the concession that, okay, sometimes you have to bend down or reach up, and occasionally, you know, something happens, and people can see, and that's forgivable. You just can't be walking around like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you stretch up to get something and people can see a gun, that's no longer an offense.
Well, that is good to know. And I will note that in the country, there are very, very few states that do not allow open carry. Florida being one, California being another, New York another. And then I believe the only other one is D.C. So there's Florida, and then there's the crazy anti-gun states. So the idea that I don't think this ban on open carry in Florida is long for this world. I think that I think that people will come to their senses and realize that we don't need to be the strange one. Very similar to New Hampshire getting rid of their carry permit requirement. And it could be because, hey, New Hampshire had like the most why bother carry permit out there. It didn't even have your picture on it. It was just your name, your address, and you paid your money. And I believe for residents, it was like $15 and it was made of paper. I remember Marco Close showed me his, and his had misspellings and stuff crossed out on it, and it was all folded up, and it was in tough shape because it's just a piece of paper and all that. And it's just one of those, like, again, it's why bother? What are we doing here? They're essentially just running a background check on you. And if you fail a background check, you can't have a gun. So why bother? And then it wasn't until Maine got constitutional carry that New Hampshire realized, oh, the only states we border that don't have constitutional carry are is Massachusetts. And so it's one of those, like, why are we siding with Massachusetts when we should be with the rest of New England? And so, yeah, I'm hoping that the open carry will be allowed in Florida sometime soon.
I guess it depends on how you interpret soon. I would say, because honestly, I'm surprised we got this far this quickly. I would say within the next 5 years.
Cool. Either way, let's hope it's sooner than that. But
agreed.
But we shall see. So, speaking of another law that was long overdue to be repealed, I sat down with Sean Sarantino to talk about the repeal of North Carolina's pistol purchase permit. I am pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Sean Sarantino. Sean is going to tell us about an event that has been a long time coming. Sean, what are we talking about?
Well, today, weird, the Jim Crow pistol purchase permit in North Carolina was finally repealed.
I'm amazed it took this long, honestly, but I am so glad to see it go.
So the pistol purchase permit in North Carolina was set up so that in order for you to buy a handgun, you had to go to the sheriff, ask permission, pay him $5 per permit, then come back when he has issued the permit within a week, pick up that permit, take it down to whoever was going to sell you the handgun, give them the permit, whether it happened to be a store or a private person, and then they could then sell you that handgun. This pistol purchase permit required somebody to go to the sheriff two times and pay $5 just to get a handgun instead of, like normal people, go down to the firearms store, say, I would like that handgun. They make you fill out the 4473. They call the FBI. The FBI says, yep, go ahead and sell it to them. They write some stuff on your 4473 and they hand you the gun. Oh, not here in North Carolina. You got to make two trips to the sheriff. And you can imagine who it is going to have the worst time going to the sheriff two separate times. It's not going to be rich people who have plenty of free time now, is it?
Well, also, that $5 has a significance too, historically, doesn't it?
Back in 1919, I believe that $5 was approximately the weekly salary of a freed slave. Basically, you worked an entire week and you got handed $5. So you were paying an entire week's salary just so that you could buy a handgun. Now, how much do you think the handgun cost, Weird?
It was about $5 as well.
For $5, you could buy a gun, and $5, you could have permission to buy the gun. And who do you think, back in the day when this was passed, well, might just not have good character, according to the sheriff or the clerk of the court?
That would be people of color.
People of color. I actually have a very interesting article that somebody found in whatever the Durham newspaper was at the time. So I don't know the name of the newspaper it actually appears in, but this is from 1930, and I want to read this to you. Pistol permits issued to many. 450 citizens received permission to buy guns since 1919. Mostly whites. A total of 450 permits to purchase pistols have been issued to Durham citizens since 1919, according to the records kept at the Office of the Clerk of Superior Court. Few permits were issued to Negroes, the records show, the issuance being restricted almost entirely to white persons. The names of many doctors and lawyers appeared in the records, while a few ministers have been issued permits to buy guns. The permits are issued by the clerk of the court, but in instances where the clerk is not personally acquainted with the applicant, it is necessary to secure a recommendation from the chief of police or the sheriff. The permits do not entitle anyone to carry the weapons on their person, it was learned. From 1919 to 1930 in the city of Durham, 450 mostly whites. And they were doctors and they were lawyers. They were the sort of people who could afford a week's salary for a freedman and a week's salary for a freedman for the permit in order to buy a handgun.
How many people back in those days were willing to walk into the sheriff's office?
Right. You knew better. It's like, if you lived in New Jersey as of 4 or 5 years ago, did you even apply to get a concealed handgun permit?
I'm pretty sure no.
Because you knew you weren't going to get it. So there was no point even wasting your time and your money to do it. How many black people in North Carolina didn't even bother to ask? Now, in North Carolina, you were required to have this pistol purchase permit to purchase any pistol, unless you had a concealed handgun permit, whether you bought that pistol from a store or from a private person. If you were to purchase a handgun from somebody without giving them a pistol purchase permit, you could have been convicted of a crime for this.
were there widespread convictions of people doing that? Because I'm sure a lot of people shirked that law.
After a record search, they found that in the last 5 years, there were a total of 4 convictions. 4.
Let's talk about this bill, because it's not just repealing of the pistol purchase permit.
There's actually 3 parts to it. I'm going to take them out of order. This is not the order they are in the bill. There is a link in the show notes to this bill. But let's go with the easiest, simplest, least important part. There's a gun safety education part. And it's, hey, let's do a thing where we tell people they should store their handguns and their firearms safely, and let's hand out some trigger locks. The second section is actually kind of interesting. So weird. Let's just say you got a wild hair and you decided you needed to go to mass because reasons. Would you look at a Catholic church and say, nothing bad could happen, I will leave my handgun at home?
I will note that the last time I was in a Catholic church, I was armed.
I'm the same way. Now, I think I go to church about as often as you do.
Potentially more.
If you went to a regular church, just a church, you in North Carolina are allowed to carry, unless they post it, no firearms. But let's say that church has a kindergarten, a preschool, a K-12 or K-6 school attached to the church, then by North Carolina law, every single part of that church ground is now an educational property, and carrying a firearm on it is a felony, even on Sunday, even when there's no school in session. So the second part of this bill, it says if there's no school in session and it's a church property, not a public school property, then if you have a concealed handgun permit, you can carry a firearm. There's a lot of people freaking out. Oh my God, you can carry a gun in a school. No, no, you can't. But what we're really here to talk about is not so much can you carry in a church if the church has a school, right? We're here for the big stuff. We're here for Jim Crow gets its butt kicked. Pistol purchase permit repeal.
Let's go over how that happened, because of course we were watching it. In a previous show, we talked about the fact that it did get vetoed by the governor, and there were some potentials that it may not have passed. But thankfully it did. So why don't you give us a recap, since I know you were watching this closer than anybody.
First thing was that there were actually 2 bills originally. There was House Bill 50, which was just a straight up pistol purchase permit repeal. That's all it had in it. Senate Bill 41, which of course, because it's a Senate bill, started in the Senate, it had the 3 things that actually got passed: gun safety education, church carry, and pistol purchase permit repeal. HB 50 passed the House. Senate Bill 41 passed the Senate, and then handed 41 to the House to pass. Senate just sort of round filed HB 50 because they had already passed 41, and that's the one they really wanted to advance. SB 41 went through all of its process and got passed by the House. The governor, once he got handed a bill, the same bills passed by both the Senate and the House, we're all familiar with how a bill becomes a law. The governor had 3 choices. Number 1, sign it, it becomes law. Number 2, veto it and kick it back. Number 3, just keep his mouth shut and sit on it, and after 10 days, it becomes law without his signature. Well, 10 days would have been Saturday. On Friday, he says, oh, hell no, and vetoes it. So this puts us in a position where, in order to make it be a law, that veto has to be overridden. The Senate has a veto-proof majority. 3/5 of the senators are Republicans. So as long as all the senators from the Republican Party show up and they all vote, then it just sails right out of the Senate. And that's exactly what happened yesterday. So here's the problem. In the House, there's 120 members. And in order to get 3/5 of 120 members, you need 72 votes to override. There's only 71 Republican House members. There's only 2 ways to make this happen. Number 1, we convince 1 Democrat, cross the aisle, cross as governor, vote with the Republicans, and override it. The other option is 2 or more Dems just happen to be absent that day, because that 3/5 majority is the 3/5 of those members present. It's not 3/5 of all of the members, it's 3/5 of all of the members that actually are present on that day. Well, if 2 or more Dems just don't show up that day, well, there we go. The majority party in the House doesn't have to tell the Democrats. They can just sit on it and wait until the day that the Democrats don't show up, don't have all their people, and then they just ambush vote it. Well, they didn't. As soon as the Senate passed it, which is to say they overrode the governor, they put it right in the House calendar. Tomorrow morning, which is today, at 9:30, as soon as we open the session, the first thing we do after we get done with the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance is we're going to vote to override the governor. if you gave them notice, that pretty much tells me that they knew they had the votes, right?
Given that we're talking right now and we're happy right now, I think so.
That's what I thought. There were three Democrats who voted to pass the bill originally and send it to the governor. So I figured, well, they talked to those three and at least one of them said, yep, I'll cross the governor on this one. Because there's problems with that. You know, the governor and the rest of the party can come after you. They must have known. One of those three was like, yes, I'm a definite yes. Go ahead and put it on the calendar. But that's not what actually happened. Three Dems just basically walked. And that meant that 71 votes is all they needed. And those three Dems who voted to advance the bill and give it to the governor voted against the bill. So they voted for the governor. They stayed with their party. But three people just took a walk and 71 votes was all they needed. Somebody had to know it was going to happen because they wouldn't have calendared it otherwise. Those three people who took a walk, they must have let the Republicans know, look, I can't vote against the governor, but I can just not be there.
It's strange that it was a different three.
And maybe we'll find out at some point, and maybe we won't. Pistol purchase permits are so far gone that the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office has already said, hey, we're not issuing these anymore. Stop asking us for them. And if you gave us $5 asking for them, we're not even going to finish the paperwork because you don't need them, and we're not giving you a refund. See ya. If you want a handgun in North Carolina, you carry your backside down to your local FFL, your local gun shop, and you say, that's the handgun I want. You fill out the 4473. You stand there while he calls the FBI. The FBI says, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that dude. Boom, done.
Just like America.
Now, I always bypass the whole thing by having a concealed handgun permit, but you shouldn't have to go through a process like that just to buy a handgun. And you definitely shouldn't have to do it on a law that was specifically passed to make sure freed black slaves and poor white, basically trash, couldn't get a handgun because it was A, too expensive, and B, it was a hassle legally, and C, the sheriff was just going to tell you no.
That's just awesome. And I got to say, my wife went to school in Chapel Hill, and we've got lots of friends down in North Carolina, and we visit it every year. North Carolina is my wife and I's tentative retirement state. We're not huge fans of Florida, so we're not going to do the standard Yankees go to die in Florida.
You're going to be halfback, you say?
Probably, I guess so. At this point in time, you know, we talked about, well, where do we go? Like, we definitely want to leave Massachusetts when, you know, my wife no longer is working there. Where do we go? And it always leads to, Florida, too flat, too hot. We don't want to go back to Maine because we don't want to go to a place where you have to shovel snow. So North Carolina is one of those. It's got snow, but it doesn't have snow, according to us. When my wife and I were first married, North Carolina had some pretty crappy gun laws, especially that I was constantly comparing Massachusetts and Maine, because I grew up in Maine and just didn't really think about gun laws. As far as Massachusetts is concerned, Maine doesn't have any. But suddenly realized that North Carolina, like many states in the South, had a lot of these really weird Jim Crow type gun laws. You couldn't carry into any establishment that had a liquor license, whether you drank or not.
There were a bunch. You couldn't carry in a place that served alcohol for on-premises consumption. You couldn't carry into a place for which an admission was charged. So you couldn't go watch a movie. You couldn't go to a dance. You couldn't go anywhere near a protest. If there was a protest, you couldn't do that. Since 2010, since the Republicans took over, GRNC has made huge strides in changing all of that. Now, I should tell you, I'm a GRNC board member now, but for years I was just a member and a helper and a volunteer. If you live in North Carolina and you care about your gun rights, you need to be a member of GRNC. So go to grnc.org and sign up for your membership.
They've been doing absolutely amazing work, and I am just so pleased to see how far North Carolina has come in really a short period of time. I'm so glad to be celebrating this most recent victory with you, Sean.
Clerk will lock the machine and record the vote. 71 having voted in the affirmative, 45 in the negative. Senate Bill 41 has passed by the requisite 3/5 vote. The override has passed, and this bill will become law, notwithstanding the objections of the governor, and the Senate's notified by special message.
So for our new listeners who have just joined us, I mentioned in a previous episode that Sean reached out to me specifically, but in my office as head of Operation Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols, to write a letter to the North Carolina General Assembly persuading them to repeal this Jim Crow law, and we were happy to help.
Yeah, no, this was good on you guys, and good on everybody who helped get this through, because this was a straight up evil law. This was designed to disarm the very people who needed personal protection. And yeah, and it was so odd that the Democrats that voted to repeal weren't the ones that conveniently stepped out to vote. Like, that makes no sense to me. It would make sense if they were the one, they voted for it because either they feel that their constituents would want that, or they personally have conscientious issues against the Jim Crow law, which why wouldn't everybody? If they're pulling down the statues of the Confederate generals in North Carolina, why on earth would they would they not be pulling down the Jim Crow laws? But the fact that they stepped out, so they've got nothing to gain. Like, if they felt like they had something to gain by voting for this law politically, then but now they've voted against it as well, so it just kind of cancels out. I could see them stepping out, because it's one thing to vote for a bipartisan bill. It's another thing to vote to override your governor, which is the same party as you. So I don't know. It was weird. So, and on top of that, the fact that they didn't use the Sean was telling me they call when they have a bill that might not be able to pass with enough of a margin. They call it the veto garage, which is essentially just the bill just sits there and it gets called out with the moment the head count's right.
The veto garage.
Yep.
I like that.
I like it too. Congratulations, North Carolina, at getting rid of this outdated and racist law.
So weird. When I took the job as hostess, I was told there would be no math. So what are these ballistic coefficients that David is talking about?
We'll let David say it for himself.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to discuss one of the contributing factors in bullet performance, commonly known as ballistic coefficient, or BC. In a previous episode, Matt from Geeks, Gadgets, and Guns talked about long-range shooting. While going over some of the details, he mentioned the effects of wind and distance on point of impact versus point of aim. In a nutshell, ballistic coefficient is a mathematical equation used to calculate a rifle bullet's efficiency in flight. Combined with other variables such as muzzle velocity, wind speed, and wind direction, it can allow a shooter to better determine the flight characteristics of a particular projectile. Typically, the higher the ballistic coefficient value, the lower the drag on the bullet and the less air resistance will affect its travel downrange. When calculating ballistic coefficient, one element of the formula is called coefficient of form, or form factor. This is related to atmospheric drag on the projectile and is based on the shape of the bullet. For example, round nose or flat point bullets, like the classic 30-30, have the lowest ballistic coefficient due to their greater drag. Flat base Spitzer projectiles, such as those in early 30-06 loads, have a much higher ballistic coefficient than round nose bullets. Spitzer rounds with a boat tail represented by the majority of modern rifle rounds have a slightly higher ballistic coefficient than Spitzer rounds with a flat base. Over the years, bullet shapes have gone through a number of revisions, yet for much of that time, ballistic coefficient models didn't reflect these changes. Eventually, several different drag curve models were developed. The most commonly used in ballistic coefficient calculations are the G1, which is a flat base blunt nose projectile like the standard 30-30 bullet I mentioned earlier, and the G7, which is a longer boat-tailed Spitzer projectile like most current rifle bullets on the market. There also exist mathematical models of form known as G2, G5, G6, G8, and GL, but these are much less frequently used. Further refinements of the G7 shape are used to produce what are called VLD, or very low drag bullets. These types of projectiles are generally long and heavy for their diameter, and often incorporate a cavity or hollow point in the nose of the bullet. Not for better expansion on impact, but to reduce projectile weight while shifting center of gravity closer to the base of the bullet, which increases stability in flight. I go into more detail on the history of bullet design in episode 113 of the podcast. There's considerably more detail to this topic than I can get into here, or, in fact, that I have a truly deep understanding of. Ballistic coefficients and related elements are a very, very deep rabbit hole. It's one of the many ways that long-range shooting is a form of weaponized math.
Mr. Charles, patrols come back. Zulus are gone. All of them. It's a miracle.
If it's a miracle, Color Sergeant, it's a short chamber Boxer Henry .45 caliber miracle.
And a bandit, sir, with some guts behind it.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I see them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. We're always looking for people interested in submitting posts to the blog, so please check out the site. Finally, I'm a published author, and books with my stories can be found on Amazon under the name Brenna Bock. That's B-R-E-N-A-B-O-C-K. I'm also in anthologies published under my actual name. Look for David Bock on Amazon, specifically on the Space Cowboys anthology. Just keep in mind I'm not the guy who writes the computer books. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Yeah, that was math. I didn't understand a lot of it.
The fat electrician refers to snipers as Bill Nye the Science Grunt. I've no experience with long range shooting. You know, my guns, I zero them at an appropriate range, and therefore I just kind of put the dot where the bullet needs to go. Still, it's my understanding that this is one of the big reasons why long range shooters have abandoned like the ubiquitous 308 Winchester match loads for 6.5 Creedmoor, as that smaller bullet has a better ballistic coefficient.
But Weird, what about your foul?
I mean,
it's 308.
I mean, yes, but it's also a tilt bolt, which is known for less accuracy. And it's also, it is such a kludge to put an optic on an FAL. And so, yeah, mine just got iron sights. I just left click the head.
Left click?
It's a gamer called the Russian Badger, and I highly recommend you looking him up.
I know who he is.
Yeah, and he was just one of the more goofy jokes is the easy way to play this game, you just left click the head.
Okay,
just put the cursor on the person.
I figured it was a mouse reference. Yeah. It was just, I don't know. It was like, but Weird, you're not left handed.
No, but. You left click the head.
It would have been funnier if you were, but.
Now Oddball joins us with another martial arts discussion. This time, it's over what's commonly known as brass knuckles.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. Recently, Weird asked me what I thought about brass knuckles, whether they were actually a useful thing or if they were just gimmicky junk. So let's talk about it. If you're unaware what brass knuckles, also known as knuckle dusters, knuckle busters, iron fists, and many other names, are a weapon that you slip over your fingers so that you strike your enemy with it as you punch them. The most recognizable version has a separate hole for each finger. While the name obviously points to brass being used, the name is often still used when referring to items made of steel, lead, wood, and even plastic. They are something that can easily and discreetly be dropped in a pocket, and just as easily discreetly be equipped. There have been examples of such weapons going back centuries. Knuckles showed up in the trenches of World War I. Soldiers either bought or made them during the Civil War. The Japanese have the teko, which resembles a stirrup from a horse saddle, and might have been where they originally came from. In India, we have the Vajra Mushti, which usually has the addition of spikes, and you can even find similar items from Roman times, some with spikes and some made of leather that were probably actually used as boxing gloves. The idea is that this item does a couple things. The most obvious is that you're striking with the brass knuckles instead of your hand. For those that haven't punched someone with a bare fist, my advice is to avoid it, if at all possible. Beyond the obvious violence bad thing, there's a pretty good chance that you'll actually hurt yourself. Your hand is made of a bunch of small, fragile bones. There's actually an injury referred to as boxer's fracture, caused by punching something wrong, and your pinky knuckle takes the brunt of the force. Since there's really nothing supporting the bone behind it, it ends up breaking. This happens regularly to boxers, even though they train constantly, specifically to punch correctly, wrap their hands in tight hand wraps, and then put on protective cushioned gloves. And that's not even getting into the dangers of punching someone in the head, which is made up of hard bones at strange angles and is full of teeth. The knuckles will protect your hand from that damage. The knuckles also add weight to the punch. This obviously adds power to your punch, what with force equals mass times acceleration and all that jazz. This is one of the two reasons for the old trick of holding a roll of coins in your hand. The other reason for the roll of quarters is to stop your hand from compressing and cushioning the blow. Obviously, this is also the case for knuckles. Finally, either due to the material used or the design, the knuckles can do more damage to the target than your fist. Unless there's spikes or something, this isn't going to happen much for body blows, but will almost certainly happen to any punches to the face. Anyone that has watched a boxing or MMA match can tell you that the human face loves to swell up or bleed when struck. And that's with trained cornermen doing everything that they can to prevent and reduce the swelling or bleeding. Like most cheap, easily concealed weapons, brass knuckles have a bit of a shady reputation. They've famously been used by criminals where they could slip the knuckles on in their coat pocket, and the intended victim doesn't know about them until they've been punched in the stomach with them. They've also been known to show up in barroom and street brawls in the wrong part of town. This is especially true where boxing is a popular sport, whether sanctioned or not. This has meant that many jurisdictions in the US and other countries have banned either the ownership or carry of them. While I'm not a lawyer, and you should always check for yourself, my research has shown that 21 states have outright banned either the carry or ownership of brass knuckles, and 17 only allow it if you have a permit. Oddly enough, of the 12 states where it's legal to own and carry without a permission slip, one of those is Hawaii. And for those that are curious, of the regular contributors to ACP, Aaron is the only one that lives in a state that allows carry of knuckles, and that's only with a permit. So, assuming you've done your homework and you live in an area where you can legally carry them, would I recommend getting a set? That's kind of a tough question to answer. There's no question in my mind that brass knuckles would be a force multiplier in a fight. A punch that might have merely hurt or momentarily stunned your opponent could very easily be turned into a strike that will injure or incapacitate them. And people tend to lose the will to fight with a broken rib or when they can't see due to their own blood in their eyes or a swollen cheek. In that sense, a cheap, light, and small thing in your pocket could be really useful. On the other hand, that concealability is also a negative when it comes to a defensive tool. While you should never pull a weapon unless you are willing to use it and feel you'll need to, there are countless cases of a, quote, nice choir boy deciding that they should be somewhere else when their intended victim pulled a gun or a knife or some other weapon. Since a large part of the knuckles are hidden when properly equipped, that factor really doesn't exist. Knuckles are weapons to be used, not displayed. Also, they probably require the most amount of training of any weapon out there. After all, if you're not able to throw a decent punch, I honestly don't see them doing a whole lot of good. Of course, I am a big fan of folks knowing the basics of hand-to-hand combat anyways, so there's that. Then there's the selection of knuckles on the market. Due to the fact that carrying them is illegal in so many areas, and to my knowledge, the carrying of them where they are legal has largely fallen out of favor. A good number of the commercially available ones are crap for their original purpose. Granted, a large percentage of them are marketed as paperweights or keychain decorations or what have you. If you're going to get some, I would go for something made of a heavier metal and that feels good in your hand. In my mind, the plastic ones are right out. Plastic tends to be weaker, super light, and often will have sharp edges or seams where the manufacturer didn't bother to finish them. I remember some where they had built-in electrodes to the knuckles so that you could tase the person you were punching. Cool. So, cheap plastic that would probably shatter under impact that housed electronics. Just what I want against my knuckles when punching something. I would also avoid the keychain or gimmicky shaped ones. While the kitty cat shaped knuckles are amusing and very cute, I have serious questions about their structural integrity. They might be fine, but without testing, I honestly have no idea. As for the keychain ones, well, you should be prepared to lose any weapon that you bring into melee combat. Not plan A by any means, but it definitely could happen. I don't know about you, but if I get into a situation in a bar or some street downtown, losing my car and house keys would be problematic. Oh, and don't get me started on the stupidity that is the advice that you should put your keys in between your knuckles. Just don't. And anyone that tells you that you should is not only wrong, but you can safely dismiss any other self-defense advice that they give you. I hope that was helpful. As always, if you want to read more of my thoughts, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for future segments, I can be reached at oddball@gunscarstech.com or on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
So FYI, this all started with me showing Oddball a heart to hurt video where he declared brass knuckles to be junk. The guy Mike who runs that show is a martial arts former cop and a martial arts training. It's a really good channel. So I left a link for that in the show notes. But it also had us talking about the fact that I got everyone for ACP as a Christmas gift the KE Arms bottle opener. Totally a bottle opener. It's not anything else than that. It's a bottle opener.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have one, Aaron.
Yes, I do have one.
It's super nice.
Mm-hmm. So because Oddball brought that up, it was I went, oh yeah, that's right. I can carry a lot of things. Let me go look at what they are. And this is relevant because in Florida, it's not a concealed pistol permit, it's a concealed weapons permit. And it covers a panoply of weapons. And so they're listed across several different statutes, but handgun, electronic weapon or device. I'm pretty sure this is a taser, either the hand version or the gas-propelled one. I don't know why, maybe because taser is a brand name, but anyway, that's what they mean by that. Tear gas gun, chemical weapon or device, which is basically the pepper spray, a knife, a billy club, a dirk. Now, if you play D&D like I do, you know that dirk is a type of dagger, and I'm not really sure why it's different from a knife. My thinking here is that this covers the big ass knives that kind of blur the line between pocket knife and, like, short sword. So something like a bowie knife, I believe, would be covered under this. Metallic knuckles, and something that's known as slingshot. And for a long time, I just thought it was a typo and they meant a slingshot. No. A slingshot, it's a maritime tool, and weird, you might know this under its other name of a monkey's fist.
Ah, yes, I am quite familiar with monkey's fist.
And how do those work in the maritime field?
Essentially, it is a weight of some sort. It might be a rock. It might be a steel ball. And there is a very specific way to tie rope around it into a tight braid. And then there's a line that comes off the bottom of it. And the intended purpose of it is that you tie it to a light line and you throw it to another boat. And then the other boat will grab that line and start pulling it, and there'll be a heavier line attached to it, and you can link up two boats. We actually used to have to use them for pair trawlers, where there was two boats mm-hmm. towing one net together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's a way, because, you know, you put it over your head, and the weight at the end, you can spin it to get a good thing going, and then whoosh, sort of like a lariat, and it makes it easier than trying to, you know, throw the rope, which is a bit like, you know, pushing a wet noodle. But, it, you know, you can also wield it like a melee weapon, because then it acts like a flail. So, that's interesting. I can carry a whole bunch of things. Plus, fun fact, in Florida, I can open carry pretty much a blade of any length. I can carry open carry a machete. I could open carry a sword if I wanted to. I mean, I would probably get all sorts of police attention, but it's not illegal.
Aaron's walking around with a Kurgan sword on her back. can you carry saps or blackjacks?
I would imagine that falls under billy clubs.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, they specifically don't mention saps, mm-hmm. but I would think that would be similar.
Yeah, I have a sap, and I am very unhappy that I don't get to carry it, because I gotta say, overall, as cool as this KE Arms knuckle duster is, it's really just cute, and I don't know if it's something that I would really want to employ as a force multiplier, just because it adds only so much more power to my fist. It doesn't add any range to it. Meanwhile, the blackjack boy, this thing is nice. Like, you could do some damage with that. And I'm sorry, I said blackjack. Blackjacks are frequently far more dangerous than saps. Saps are essentially a flat paddle shape, and that is much more conducive to knocking someone unconscious than doing more serious damage. But of course, you know, everything is potentially lethal. Though I know for a fact you can carry saps in North Carolina. And actually, back when, as Sean mentioned, it used to be you couldn't carry into any place that served alcohol, but it was specified you couldn't carry a firearm. And so people would often carry saps and knives and stuff into bars, because at least you'd have something.
I was checking, and I can't find anything from, like, a legal firm that says blackjacks are allowed. I mean, I would think so. I figure if you can carry a club, you can carry a sap, but I can't say definitively yet.
No. Either way, maybe we'll hear from a Florida listener.
But I have a link in the show notes to a law firm that mentions... And by the way, this particular law firm is called Katz and Phillips, but their URL is thefirearmfirm.com. So I would imagine they know what they're talking about, and they're good folks.
Yeah, it's a good URL.
But I can't find anything in there about saps.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. Hey, Weird, you know who aren't saps?
Our listeners! And we've got to thank them. Thank you so much, each and every one of you, for listening to our show. It would be foolish of us just to be talking to nobody.
Although you'd do that. You would totally do that.
You don't know what happens when I'm home alone. Stop pretending like you do.
Probably for the best.
I was not playing with my dolls again.
Is that what you call your penis?
I'm going to leave it with that. Just going to leave it. I'm just not touching it.
Oh, God. You're not going to touch your penis? Okay.
If you want to support the show, you can also go to patreon.com/ASOTA Gordon Calibers Podcast to sign up to be one of our patrons and get ACP blooper reel. If you think what Aaron doing to me right now is funny, it gets worse. There's also the ACP film tracks, and there is the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can get more from me at linktree.com/AaronPaulette. That's linktree.ee/AaronPaulette, all one word.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
I mean, I sit down to pee. I don't know how he's going to do it, because he just told me he's not going to touch that. So, our potty styles are assorted, in this case, likely messy. And so is our podcast. Good night, everyone.
I'm in charge of cleaning the bathrooms. I'll do what I want.